Chapter 25. The suspicious circumstances which invest him will be found to tally much better with my hypothesis of romantic busybodyism than with the reasoner's suggestion of guilt. Once adopting the more charitable interpretation, we shall find no difficulty in comprehending the rose in the keyhole, the Marie upon the slate, the elbowing the male relatives out of the way, apostrophe the aversion to permitting them to see the body, apostrophe the caution given to Madame B, that she must hold no conversation with the gendarme until his return Beauvais, and, lastly, his apparent determination that nobody should have anything to do with the proceedings except himself. It seems to me unquestionable that Beauvais was a suitor of Marie's, that she coquetted with him, and that he was ambitious of being thought to enjoy her fullest intimacy and confidence. I shall say nothing more upon this point, and, as the evidence fully rebuts the assertion of Ledel, touching the matter of apathy on the part of the mother and other relatives and apathy inconsistent with the supposition of their believing the corpse to be that of the perfumery girl, we shall now proceed, as if the question of identity were settled to our perfect satisfaction. And what, I hear demanded, do you think of the opinions of Le Commercial? That, in spirit, they are far more worthy of attention than any which have been promulgated upon the subject. The deductions from the premises are philosophical and acute, but the premises, in two instances, at least, are founded in imperfect observation. Le Commercial wishes to intimate that Marie was seized by some gang of low ruffians not far from her mother's door. It is impossible, it urges, that a person so well known to thousands as this young woman was, should have passed three blocks without someone having seen her. This is the idea of a man long resident in Paris, a public man and one whose walks to and fro in the city have been mostly limited to the vicinity of the public offices. He is aware that he seldom passes so far as a dozen blocks from his own bureau without being recognized and accosted. And, knowing the extent of his personal acquaintance with others, and of others with him, he compares his notoriety with that of the perfumery girl, finds no great difference between them, and reaches at once the conclusion that she, in her walks, would be equally liable to recognition with himself in his. This could only be the case were her walks of the same unvarying methodical character, and within the same species of limited region as are his own. He passes to and fro, at regular intervals, within a confined periphery, abounding in individuals who are led to observation of his person through interest in the kindred nature of his occupation with their own. But the walks of Marie may, in general, be supposed discursive. In this particular instance, it will be understood as most probable that she proceeded upon a route of more than average diversity from her accustomed ones. The parallel which we imagine to have existed in the mind of Le Commercial would only be sustained in the event of the two individuals traversing the whole city. In this case, granting the personal acquaintances to be equal, the chances would be also equal that an equal number of personal rencounters would be made. For my own part, I should hold it, not only as possible, but as very far more than probable, that Marie might have proceeded, at any given period, by any one of the many routes between her own residence and that of her aunt, without meeting a single individual whom she knew, or by whom she was known. In viewing this question in its full and proper light, we must hold steadily in mind the great disproportion between the personal acquaintances of even the most noted individual in Paris, and the entire population of Paris itself. But whatever force there may still appear to be in the suggestion of Le Commercial will be much diminished when we take into consideration the hour at which the girl went abroad. It was when the streets were full of people, says Le Commercial, that she went out. But not so. It was at 9 o'clock in the morning. Now at 9 o'clock of every morning in the week, with the exception of Sunday, the streets of the city are, it is true, thronged with people. At 9 on Sunday, the populace are chiefly within doors preparing for church. No observing person can have failed to notice the peculiarly deserted air of the town, from about 8 until 10 on the morning of every Sabbath. Between 10 and 11 the streets are thronged, but not at so early a period as that designated. There is another point at which there seems a deficiency of observation on the part of Le Commercial. A piece, apostrophe it says, of one of the unfortunate girl's petticoats, 2 feet long, and 1 foot wide, was torn out and tied under her chin, and around the back of her head, probably to prevent screams. This was done by fellows who had no pocket handkerchiefs. Apostrophe apostrophe whether this idea is, or is not well founded, we will endeavor to see hereafter. But by fellows who have no pocket handkerchiefs the editor intends the lowest class of ruffians. These, however, are the very description of people who will always be found to have handkerchiefs, even when destitute of shirts. You must have had occasion to observe how absolutely indispensable, of late years, to the thorough blackguard, has become the pocket handkerchief. And what are we to think, I asked, of the article in La Salle? That it is a vast pity its editor was not born a parrot, in which case he would have been the most illustrious parrot of his race. He has merely repeated the individual items of the already published opinion, collecting them, with a laudable industry, from this paper and from that. The things had all evidently been there, apostrophe he says, comma at least, 3 or 4 weeks, and there can be no doubt that the spot of this appalling outrage has been discovered. Apostrophe apostrophe the facts here restated by La Salle are very far indeed from removing my own doubts upon this subject, and we will examine them more particularly hereafter in connection with another division of the theme. At present we must occupy ourselves with other investigations. You cannot fail to have remarked the extreme laxity of the examination of the corpse. To be sure, the question of identity was readily determined, or should have been, but there were other points to be ascertained. Had the body been in any respect despoiled? Had the deceased any articles of jewelry about her person upon leaving home? If so, had she anyone found? These are important questions utterly untouched by the evidence, and there are others of equal moment, which have met with no attention. We must endeavor to satisfy ourselves by personal inquiry. The case of St. Eustache must be re-examined. I have no suspicion of this person, but let us proceed methodically. We will ascertain beyond a doubt the validity of the affidavits in regard to his whereabouts on the Sunday. Affidavits of this character are readily made matter of mystification. Should there be nothing wrong here, however, we will dismiss St. Eustache from our investigations. His suicide, however corroborative of suspicion, were there found to be deceit in the affidavits, is, without such deceit, in no respect an unaccountable circumstance, or one which need cause us to deflect from the line of ordinary analysis. In that which I now propose, we will discard the interior points of this tragedy, and concentrate our attention upon its outskirts. Not the least usual error, in investigations such as this, is the limiting of inquiry to the immediate, with total disregard of the collateral or circumstantial events. It is the malpractice of the courts to confine evidence and discussion to the bounds of apparent relevancy. Yet experience has shown, and a true philosophy will always show, that a vast, perhaps the larger portion of truth, arises from the seemingly irrelevant. It is through the spirit of this principle, if not precisely through its letter, that modern science has resolved to calculate upon the unforeseen. But perhaps you do not comprehend me. The history of human knowledge has so uninterruptedly shown that to collateral, or incidental, or accidental events we are indebted for the most numerous and most valuable discoveries, that it has at length become necessary, in any prospective view of improvement, to make not only large, but the largest allowances for inventions that shall arise by chance, and quite out of the range of ordinary expectation. it is no longer philosophical to base, upon what has been, a vision of what is to be. Accident is admitted as a portion of the substructure. We make chance a matter of absolute calculation. We subject the unlooked for and unimagined to the mathematical formulae of the schools. I repeat that it is no more than fact that the larger portion of all truth has sprung from the collateral, and it is but in accordance with the spirit of the principle involved in this fact that I would divert inquiry, in the present case, from the trodden and hitherto unfruitful ground of the event itself, to the contemporary circumstances which surround it. While you ascertain the validity of the affidavits, I will examine the newspapers more generally than you have as yet done. So far, we have only reconnoitered the field of investigation, but it will be strange indeed if a comprehensive survey, such as I propose, of the public prints, will not afford us some minute points which shall establish a direction for inquiry. In pursuance of Dupin's suggestion, I made scrupulous examination of the affair of the affidavits. The result was a firm conviction of their validity, and of the consequent innocence of St. Eustache. In the meantime, my friend occupied himself, with what seemed to me a minuteness altogether objectless, in a scrutiny of the various newspaper files. At the end of a week he placed before me the following extracts. About 3 years and a half ago, a disturbance very similar to the present was caused by the disappearance of this same Marie Rogti from the perfumery of Monsieur Leblanc in the Palace Royal. At the end of a week, however, she reappeared at her customary comptoir, as well as ever, with the exception of a slight paleness not altogether usual. It was given out by Monsieur Leblanc and her mother that she had merely been on a visit to some friend in the country, and the affair was speedily hushed up. We presume that the present absence is a freak of the same nature, and that, at the expiration of a week, or perhaps of a month, we shall have her among us again. Evening paper Monday, June 23rd.
*17.
An evening journal of yesterday refers to a former mysterious disappearance of Mademoiselle Rogti. It is well known that, during the week of her absence from Leblanc's perfumery, she was in the company of a young naval officer, much noted for his debaucheries. A quarrel, it is supposed, providentially led to her return home. We have the name of the Lothario in question, who is, at present, stationed in Paris, but, for obvious reasons, forbear to make it public. Le Mercury, Tuesday morning, June 24.
*18.
An outrage of the most atrocious character was perpetrated near this city the day before yesterday. A gentleman, with his wife and daughter, engaged, about dusk, the services of 6 young men, who were idly rowing a boat to and fro near the banks of the Seine, to convey him across the river. Upon reaching the opposite shore, the 3 passengers stepped out, and had proceeded so far as to be beyond the view of the boat, when the daughter discovered that she had left in it her parasol. She returned for it, was seized by the gang, carried out into the stream, gagged, brutally treated, and finally taken to the shore at a point not far from that at which she had originally entered the boat with her parents. The villains have escaped for the time, but the police are upon their trail, and some of them will soon be taken. Morning paper June 25.
*19.
We have received 1 or 2 communications, the object of which is to fasten the crime of the late atrocity upon Menace.
*20,
but as this gentleman has been fully exonerated by a loyal inquiry, and as the arguments of our several correspondents appear to be more zealous than profound, we do not think it advisable to make them public. Morning paper June 28.
*21,
we have received several forcibly written communications, apparently from various sources, and which go far to render it a matter of certainty that the unfortunate Marie Rogti has become a victim of one of the numerous bands of blackguards which infest the vicinity of the city upon Sunday. Our own opinion is decidedly in favor of this supposition. We shall endeavor to make room for some of these arguments hereafter. Evening paper Tuesday, June 31st. Asterisk 22, on Monday, one of the barchmen connected with the revenue service saw an empty boat floating down the Seine. Sails were lying in the bottom of the boat. The barchman towed it under the barge office. The next morning it was taken from thence, without the knowledge of any of the officers. The rudder is now at the barge office. La Diligence Thursday, June 26th. And sect. Upon reading these various extracts, they not only seemed to me irrelevant, but I could perceive no mode in which any one of them could be brought to bear upon the matter in hand. I waited for some explanation from Dupin. It is not my present design, he said, to dwell upon the first and second of those extracts. I have copied them, chiefly to show you the extreme remissness of the police, who, as far as I can understand from the prefect, have not troubled themselves, in any respect, with an examination of the naval officer alluded to. Yet it is mere folly to say that between the first and second disappearance of Marie, there is no supposable connection. Let us admit the first elopement to have resulted in a quarrel between the lovers, and the return home of the betrayed. We are now prepared to view a second elopement if we know that an elopement has again taken place, as indicating a renewal of the betrayer's advances, rather than as the result of new proposals by a second individual. We are prepared to regard it as a making up of the old amour, rather than as the commencement of a new one. The chances are 10 to 1 that he who had once eloped with Marie would again propose an elopement, rather than that she to whom proposals of elopement had been made by one individual should have them made to her by another. And here let me call your attention to the fact that the time elapsing between the first ascertained and the second supposed elopement is a few months more than the general period of the cruises of our men of war. Had the lover been interrupted in his first villainy by the necessity of departure to sea, and had he seized the first moment of his return to renew the base designs not yet altogether accomplished or not yet altogether accomplished by him? Of all these things we know nothing. You will say, however, that, in the second instance, there was no elopement as imagined. Certainly not, but are we prepared to say that there was not the frustrated design? Beyond St. Eustache, and perhaps Beauvais, we find no recognized, no open, no honorable suitors of Marie. Of none other is there anything said. Who, then, is the secret lover, of whom the relatives, at least most of them, know nothing, but whom Marie meets upon the morning of Sunday, and who is so deeply in her confidence that she hesitates not to remain with him until the shades of the evening descend, amid the solitary groves of the Barrière du Raoul? Who is that secret lover, I ask, of whom, at least, most of the relatives know nothing? And what means the singular prophecy of Madame Rogti on the morning of Marie's departure? I fear that I shall never see Marie again. Apostrophe, but if we cannot imagine Madame Rogti privy to the design of elopement, may we not at least suppose this design entertained by the girl? Upon quitting home, she gave it to be understood that she was about to visit her aunt in the Rue des Docteurs Mess, and Saint Eustache was requested to call for her at dark. Now, at first glance, this fact strongly militates against my suggestion, but let us reflect that she did meet some companion, and proceed with him across the river, reaching the Barrière du Raoul at so late an hour as 3 o'clock in the afternoon, is known. But in consenting so to accompany this individual, for whatever purpose to her mother known or unknown, she must have thought of her expressed intention when leaving home, and of the surprise and suspicion aroused in the bosom of her affianced suitor, Saint Eustache, when, calling for her, at the hour appointed, in the Rue des Docteurs Mess, he should find that as he had not been there, and when, moreover, upon returning to the pension with this alarming intelligence, he should become aware of her continued absence from home. She must have thought of these things, I say. She must have foreseen the chagrin of St. Eustache, the suspicion of all. She could not have thought of returning to brave this suspicion. But the suspicion becomes a point of trivial importance to her, if we suppose her not intending to return. We may imagine her thinking thus: I am to meet a certain person for the purpose of elopement, or for certain other purposes known only to myself. It is necessary that there be no chance of interruption. There must be sufficient time given us to elude pursuit. I will give it to be understood that I shall visit and spend the day with my aunt at the Rue des Docteurs Mess. I will tell Saint Eustache not to call for me until dark. In this way, my absence from home for the longest possible period, without causing suspicion or anxiety, will be accounted for, and I shall gain more time than in any other manner. If I bid Saint Eustache call for me at dark, he will be sure not to call before. But, if I wholly neglect to bid him call, my time for escape will be diminished, since it will be expected that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.